From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Leyla Zana. She spoke a sentence in Kurdish in the Turkish parliament and paid for it with nearly a decade in prison. Last night, she was released. Today on Democracy Now!, we'll go to Turkey and we'll continue our series Remembering the Dead. We'll look at Reagan administration policy towards AIDS.
Ronald Reagan was the president when AIDS got started. He was silent about it for 6 or 7 years, and it raged out of control because of his active policy of indifference.
And we'll look at the Reagan administration policy toward the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
CIA and Pakistani intelligence and Saudi intelligence persisted in supporting the most radical Islamist groups among those who had battled the Soviets, and that support created the context in which al-Qaeda was born, in which bin Laden rose to claim global leadership of the jihad.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Turkey, the prominent Kurdish leader Leyla Zana was released yesterday after 10 years in jail. She's the leading symbol of the fight for Kurdish rights in Turkey. The former legislator, who's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, first gained international attention in 1991 when she spoke in Kurdish during her oath of allegiance to parliament, causing an uproar in the country. 3 years later, she and three other Kurdish legislators from the pro-Kurdish Democracy Party were jailed, allegedly for having ties with the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party. Human rights groups in the European Union have long protested their detention. While Zana was released, her sentence has only been appealed, not dropped. On July 8th, her appeal begins. She could face more prison time just hours before their release. Turkish state-run television began for the first time broadcasting programs in the long-banned Kurdish language. The move comes as Turkey's applying for membership in the European Union. Global military spending around the world reached nearly $1 trillion last year. The United States spent almost more money than all of the other countries in the world combined. The world total marks 11% jump over the past year. The group Stockholm International Peace Research Institute said the jump is a, quote, remarkable increase. According to the group, the U.S. accounted for 47% of the total spending. Japan accounted for 5%. Britain, France, and China each accounted for 4%. The Center for Constitutional Rights filed a class action lawsuit yesterday against two private military contractors, Titan Corporation and CACI International, for the role of their employees in abusing and torturing detainees in Iraq. The suit alleges contractors conspired to execute, rape, and torture prisoners during interrogations to boost profits from military payments. The suit seeks payment for torture detainees and a ban on future government contracts for the two corporations. The head of the Army training operations in Iraq said the country's attempt to train an Iraqi police force has largely failed. He said, quote, "It hasn't gone well. We've had almost 1 year of no progress." In April, the Iraqi forces faced their first big test when the resistance movement rose up in Fallujah, Najaf, and Karbala. Half of the newly trained police and military forces deserted instead of fighting against fellow Iraqis. The State Department's been forced to correct major portions of its annual report on global terrorism that was released 2 months ago after major mistakes were cited. The original report concluded the number of terrorist attacks in the world in 2003 had dropped to its lowest level in 34 years. Now the report will be rewritten, and it may show 2003 had more attacks than any year in the last 2 decades. Congressmember Henry Waxman of California accused the administration of manipulating terrorism data so it could claim victory in the so-called war on terror. 11 Chinese workers have been shot dead in northern Afghanistan in one of the worst attacks on foreigners in the country since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. 50 million telephone customers in the U.S. could soon face higher phone bills after the Bush administration announced it no longer supports a law that requires the four regional bell companies who control the phone lines to give their rivals access to the lines at discounted prices in order to spur competition. The Supreme Court is currently reviewing whether the four companies, Verizon, SBC Communications, Bell South, and Quest, must allow competing companies to use their phone lines at a subsidized cost since the Bells have a near monopoly on the phone lines. Not everyone in the Bush administration is in agreement to the policy change. President Bush's chief advisor, Karl Rove, fears customers who face larger phone bills may be less likely to vote for Bush. The popular Haitian folk singer and voodoo priestess Anne Auguste, who was a backer of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, has now spent a month in Haiti in jail after U.S. Marines arrested her. She is commonly known as Soane, Creole for Sister Anne. On May 10th, Marines raided her house in the middle of the night. Marines used explosives to break down her front door, killed her two dogs, handcuffed her five-year-old grandson, and arrested Auguste and 10 others. In a statement from jail, she said she's being held as a political prisoner. Quote, I think none of us will ever be able to forget the inhumane treatment we were subjected to in the course of this violent action undertaken in the name of the Bush government for what he calls building democracy in my homeland, Auguste said. According to Newsday, the Marines allege the singer met with a small group of Muslims in Haiti to organize attacks on the U.S. forces who've been in Haiti since the coup that ousted the democratically elected Aristide. Auguste lived in Brooklyn, New York for 20 years before returning in the 94. When Aristide returned to power after the first coup against him. In Brooklyn, she regularly sang at massive gatherings, including one event in Central Park that attracted 25,000 people. She writes from jail, quote, they may imprison my body, but they will never imprison the truth I know in my soul. I will continue to fight for justice and truth in Haiti until I draw my last breath. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world if you're listening in on democracynow.org.
Well, big news last night out of Turkey. The Kurdish leader Leyla Zana was freed after spending 10 years in jail. A Turkish court ordered the release of Leyla Zana along with three other Kurdish activists after a state prosecutor called for their sentences to be quashed. Their trials have been widely condemned by human rights groups.
Zana's release comes amid repeated warnings from European institutions that the continued imprisonment of the four legislators would affect Turkey's efforts to join the European Union. After their release, Turkish Minister Semih Sisek said, quote, "This is the last bargaining chip in the hands of those who were seeking excuses in Turkey's EU bid."
Leyla Zana rose to prominence in 1991 when she became the first ever Kurdish woman to be elected to the Turkish parliament. In Turkey, the Kurdish language was banned, publications proscribed, broadcasters prosecuted. After she was elected in 1991, Leyla Zana dared to speak Kurdish in the Turkish parliament and wear the Kurdish colors in her headband. The move caused an uproar in the country. She was later sentenced to 14 years in jail. We're now going to play the historic moment for you in its original language with translation over it. This was Leyla Zana in 1991 when she stood up and walked to the podium.
Leyla Zana.
I swear by my honor and my dignity before the great Turkish people to protect the integrity and independence of the state, the indivisible unity of people and homeland, and the unquestionable and unconditional sovereignty of the people. I swear loyalty to the Constitution. I take this oath for the brotherhood between the Turkish people and the Kurdish people.
The commotion was caused by that last sentence, which she said in Kurdish, "I take this oath for the brotherhood between the Turkish people and the Kurdish people." At her trial, in which she was sentenced to 14 years in prison, Leyla Zana said, quote, "This is a conspiracy. What I am defending is perfectly clear." This is Leyla Zana.
This is a conspiracy. What I am defending is perfectly clear. I don't accept any of these accusations. And if they were true, I'd assume responsibility for them, even if it cost me my life. I have defended democracy, human rights, and brotherhood between peoples, and I'll keep doing so for as long as I live.
That was Leyla Zana at her trial. We turn now to Turkey, to Jonathan Suktan of Human Rights Watch, who was with Leyla Zana and the three other Kurdish prisoners when they were released last night. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Can you tell us the scene last night?
Yes, in fact, I was in Ankara for some meetings with the government, and I was in a meeting together with some other human rights organizations, some local and international human rights organizations, in a meeting at the part of the foreign ministry that deals with the relations with the European Union. And just as we finished the meeting, somebody got a message on their phone that Leyla Zana and the others had been released, which was very exciting because, you know, I've worked on this case for 10 years, and I knew, you know, quite close contact with all these MPs, in the years before they became MPs, when they were still working for human rights organizations, and then after they were elected. So it was the end of a long, long story, and a very thrilling end, really. They were released at 5:30 last night, and later in the evening, I went to see them at a restaurant in Ankara, where they were sort of receiving the good wishes of their sort of friends and contacts. And this is the thing that was very surprising. We watched their emergence from prison on television. I had expected that the police would completely evacuate the area and try to get the MPs away in a sort of secretive, hugger-mugger sort of way. But in fact, there was a huge crowd, thousands of people outside the gates of the prison in Ankara. And it was a, you know, it was definitely a Nelson Mandela moment, which is something that has been long needed, really, in Turkey, a sort of cathartic moment. And I think that was it last night.
We're also joined by telephone from Turkey by Shinad Yurdatapan, who is a Turkish human rights activist and musician. He's a leader of the Freedom of Thought campaign in Turkey. He's been arrested in jail several times by the Turkish government on charges of supporting Kurds. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Could you tell us your reaction and that of the human rights movement to last night's release, and also a little? How is the Turkish press covering this whole issue?
Well, first for us, it was a very happy moment, as Jonathan also told, a bit unexpected, expected but not so soon. Also private happiness for me too, because in 1997, when I was first taken the custody and then arrested, I stayed in the same prison with them, and a few times I was allowed to meet them, and so another sort of friendship comes out then. And the press coverage too big, of course. All the first pages of all newspapers today, and that was the number one news on television, almost in each and every channel. And reactions are mostly positive. Even the negative ones, they say that it's a political decision to send a message to European Union. Well, of course it is, because this case itself is not a case law, but it is a totally political case. But it's very good that the case will be reopened, and so that this time, I believe, people of Turkey will also have the chance to learn the truth behind that. It is a really complot-smelling case, nearly created by Nuhmet Yüksel, the famous former, one of the former prosecutors of State Security Court.
With the upcoming NATO summit, people are being arrested in Turkey?
Yes. Today we also protested that together with many human rights organizations and presidents of Turkish PAN, Turkish Publishers Union, etc., because lots of people are being arrested. And many very democratic organizations and some political magazines, offices, and even a press agency, digital press agency. We were there today. 2 days ago, they were police was there, and they took many documents away. It's I think it has two purposes. One, to make the organizations restless, and they don't want to make demonstrations. This is a very old tradition in Turkey, and usually in the Cold War times, the people who are known as leftists should usually be picked up by police on 28th or 29th of April and released on 2nd of May, so that there would be no demonstrations on 1st of May. The same habit is going on, I'm afraid. And on the 2nd, that's from time to time, they like to make such oppression. And this time, there should be another meeting, because the Kurdish transmission, although very limited, but it was the first time on Turkish state radio television transmitted them. And this may be a sort of message to conservative people and organizations, saying that don't worry, it's just a show-off, but we will not let them work freely.
I'd like to bring in Jonathan Sudan again and ask him, with Turkey poised to enter the European Union, we've got about 30 seconds left. If you could tell us what you think the impact will be on the issue of Kurdish rights within Turkey if it does enter the European Union.
Well, yesterday as a whole was a very significant day, because in the morning we saw the first broadcast on state television in Kurdish, and it's a very small start, just a 15-minute program that's going to be once a week. I mean, almost comic. But on the other hand, we know that this is the beginning of an expansion. There will be more on television. There will be private stations. We know that's going to happen in the future. And this was the sort of the release of the debt parliamentarians, who, of course, were also their arrest started with words that were spoken in Kurdish. This does seem like the significant turning point on that subject.
And Leyla Zana's words when she came out of prison?
Well, perhaps Shana was able to follow the broadcast at that moment. I mean, I spoke to her later in the evening, and she said that she had was still completely committed to exactly the same goals that she was when she went into prison, and she expected support from civil society in giving her the liberty to pursue those goals. The speech just outside the statement that she made immediately after she was released, I missed it. Perhaps Shana followed that.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We've been joined by Jonathan Sukden of Human Rights Watch. He is in Turkey, as well as Sanad Yurtatapan, who is a Turkish human rights activist himself, jailed as well. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we are remembering the dead. We will begin in Afghanistan. We will look at the Reagan years and the Mujahideen. Then we will come back to this country and look at AIDS. Stay with us.
شدم دیوانه دیوانه رو یا شدم دیوانه دیوانه رو یا شدم دیوانه او دیوانه رو یا
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 220 Pacifica and NPR radio stations, public access TV stations, PBS, and on Dish Network, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, and the largest public media collaboration in the country. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
And we move to our next segment. The body of former President Ronald Reagan arrived in Washington yesterday for America's first state funeral in three decades. After landing at Andrews Air Force Base, Reagan's flag-draped coffin was taken on a final parade through Washington to the Capitol Rotunda. As many as 150,000 people are expected to view his casket before it is returned to California for tomorrow's state funeral. Vice President Dick Cheney opened the 34-hour period of Reagan's lying in state by saying, quote, it was the vision and the will of Ronald Reagan that gave hope to the oppressed, shamed the oppressors, and ended the evil empire. What Cheney, along with the corporate media, failed to mention yesterday was the Reagan administration's role in financing, arming, and training what was destined to become some of America's worst enemies in the Middle East and Asia.
During most of the 1980s, the CIA secretly sent billions of dollars of military aid to Afghanistan to support the Mujahideen, or Holy Warriors, against the Soviet Union, which had invaded in 1979. The U.S.-supported jihad succeeded in driving out the Soviets, but the Afghan factions, once allied to the U.S., eventually gave rise to the oppressive Taliban and Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda. Today, we're going to take a look at America's role in Afghanistan and the roots of 9-1-1 with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Cole. He's managing editor of The Washington Post and author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10th, 2001. Steve Cole joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
Very good to have you with us. You write that the CIA, the KGB, Pakistan's ISI, and Saudi Arabia's General Intelligence Department all operated directly and secretly in Afghanistan. They primed Afghan factions with cash and weapons, secretly trained guerrilla forces, funded propaganda, manipulated politics. In the midst of these struggles, bin Laden conceived and then built his global organization. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of this history, which you, to say the least, very comprehensively deal with in Ghost Wars?
Well, it, of course, begins in 1979 when the Soviets invaded during the Carter administration, and it really swelled between 1981 and 1985. Essentially, under Bill Casey, the CIA created a three-part intelligence alliance to fund and arm the Mujahideen, and to initially to harass Soviet occupation forces, and eventually they embraced the goal of driving them out. And the three-way alliance, each of the parties had a distinct role to play. For the Saudis, their intelligence service primarily provided cash. Each year, the Congress would secretly allocate a certain amount of money to support the CIA's program. After that allocation was complete, the U.S. intelligence liaison would fly to Riyadh, and the Saudis would write a matching check. The U.S. role was to provide logistics and technological support as well as money. And the Saudis really collaborated with Pakistan's intelligence service, ISI, to really run the war on the front lines. It was the Pakistani army, and particularly ISI, that picked the political winners and losers in the jihad, and who favored radical Islamist factions because it suited the Pakistan army's goal of pacifying Afghanistan, a long-time unruly neighbor to the West, whose ethnic Pashtun nationalism the army feared. And the army saw Islam not only as a motivating force in the anti-Soviet jihad, but as an instrument of Pakistan's regional policy to control Afghanistan. The U.S. acquiesced with all of this, in part because they thought that the only purpose that brought them to the region was to drive the Soviets out, and they didn't really care about local politics. But also because after Vietnam, the generation of CIA officers involved in this program were scarred by their experiences in Southeast Asia, and they essentially operated under a mantra of no more hearts and minds for us. We're not good at picking winners and losers in the developing world. Let's let the Pakistanis decide who carries this jihad forward. And that's how the favoritism of the radical Islamic factions, I think, was born and nurtured.
And Steve, at what point in this process did the Mujahideen basically turn their guns around? Was the United States aware at the point at which their allies had begun to target them for their next jihad?
Yeah, it's a good question. It happened gradually in the late 1980s. Certainly there were people in the early 80s involved in the program who were aware that many of America's favorite clients were fundamentally anti-American in their outlook, but it was only in the late 1980s as the amounts of money and guns and really the success of the jihad began to swell that clients such as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Abdul Sayyaf, who were two of the most vehemently anti-American leaders of the jihad, began to explicitly turn their propaganda pamphlets and their, at least their rhetorical efforts against the United States as well as against the Soviet Union. as that began to happen, to the second part of your question, there were individuals inside the U.S. bureaucracy at the State Department elsewhere who began to warn that the United States needed to change its political approach to this covert action program, that they needed now to start getting involved in the messy business of Afghan politics and to start to promote more centrist factions and to negotiate compromise with the Soviet-backed communist government in Kabul to prevent Islamist extremists from coming to power as the Soviets withdrew. These warnings, when you look at them with the benefit of hindsight, are really quite prescient and certainly were strongly given, but they languished in the middle of the bureaucracy and were largely ignored by both the second-term Reagan administration and the first Bush administration, Bush 41.
We're talking to Steve Cole. He is managing editor of the Washington Post, and he has written the book Ghost Wars, the Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. Can you talk about the role of Kashmir in all of this, of the conflict in Kashmir?
After the Soviets withdrew in 1988, the Pakistan Army and Intelligence Service interpreted this victory as essentially providing them a model for combating their neighbor to the east, India, a country with a much larger standing army, much greater industrial potential, and a much larger population base that threatened, at least in the Pakistan Army's view, Pakistan's national existence. And as a spontaneous indigenous rebellion against corrupt Indian rule began in Kashmir in 1989, the Pakistan Army and Intelligence Service began to pour in support for Islamist factions using not only the model of the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan, but also many of the training camp facilities that had been built up to support the Afghan war. And so they began, and they also used many of the same Muslim Brotherhood influence networks to essentially take over the Kashmir Rebellion and try to turn it into an instrument of Pakistan's national policy, an effort in which they were partially successful by the mid-1990s. So what it means as a practical matter, looking at al-Qaeda, is that as bin Laden began to use the sanctuary of Afghanistan to develop his global ambitions and his global organization, he found indirect and sometimes direct support from the Pakistan Army, which sought to use his infrastructure to run their own jihad in Kashmir. And the Pakistan Army's purpose in Kashmir was, of course, to support what they viewed as the liberation of an occupied territory. But sometimes more cynically, they sought to just tie down the Indian Army in Kashmir, and they succeeded. They tied down 600,000 Indian troops by running the kind of cross-border Islamist jihad that they had, in effect, rehearsed in Afghanistan.
And, Steve, I'd like to ask you, to what degree was the U.S. policy of supporting the Mujahideen or its policy in Pakistan an aberration, and to what degree was it a continuation of policy in the Middle East? Because I don't know if you've read the book by Tariq Ali, The Clash of Fundamentalisms, where he posits that this has been a historical pattern in the Middle East, that the British and the United States have supported right-wing or religious organizations and groups covertly or sometimes overtly to stop modernist governments such as Nasser in Egypt or even Gandhi in India, as well as more leftist-oriented governments throughout the region. And this has been a historical pattern.
Yeah, I think there is a pattern of that kind. I mean, it's not comprehensive, but it's certainly prevalent through the history that you refer to. In the Cold War period, I think there was a real belief, certainly by Bill Casey, who was a devout Catholic, and by the Saudi royal family, that the support of religious networks and organizations against Soviet-supported either communist or leftist governments was not only a sort of a good tactics, but but it was also righteous. It was the battle of the faithful against the godless was really, I think, at some personal level, how Casey and some of the Saudis saw it. As you say, that wasn't a spontaneous idea. It was rooted in approaches that governments had taken, the British and the United States, when secular socialist governments had risen in the Middle East earlier. The British had certainly supported the Muslim Brotherhood as an instrument of challenge against Nasser once they were concerned about Nasser's ambitions. At the same time, the Muslim Brotherhood had been born as an anti-colonial, anti-British force. So it, you know, it sort of swung, the pendulum swung both ways. You know, the other thing is worth noting, during the 1980s, it's generally agreed now, though a lot of the details are not available, that the Israelis supported Hamas covertly as an instrument of sort of as a covert program to create a rival movement within the Palestinian community against the PLO. And now, presumably, regret that strategy as well.
How did the Reagan administration, how did President Reagan describe what was happening in Afghanistan during the time? What awareness did Americans have of what was going on in the 1980s in Afghanistan and the U.S. support for the Mujahideen?
It's interesting to go back and look at the public discourse about this, during the Reagan years in particular, it was a very superficial. Certainly there was a... Reagan often used the terminology of his, of freedom. These were freedom fighters. These were noble freedom fighters. There was a sense of... I don't want to overstate this, but they were almost... The Afghans were regarded with some distance and condescension, almost as noble savages, you know, in some sort of state of purity, fighting for some abstract idea of freedom. And the idea that Afghanistan was a messy place filled with complexity and ethnicity and tribal structures and all of the rest of what we now understand about Afghanistan was generally not part of American public discourse. You know, by contrast, the covert wars in Central America were much richer controversies in the United States, and they were often discussed in much greater detail and nuance in Congress and elsewhere. Of course, the support for the Contras became a raging controversy by the second term of the Reagan administration. Afghanistan never became such a program. It attracted bipartisan support and a general quietude throughout, I think in part because it was so far away, in part because the war was one between an occupied people and the Soviet army. This was not this was not proxies on both sides. This was a direct invasion that was generally regarded as unjust across the developing world. The United States didn't play a very direct role on the front lines of the jihad. There were not Americans in tennis shoes generally standing up on the Khyber Pass getting shot or creating episodes. This was a war in which the United States acted as quartermaster and let the Pakistani intelligence service run things on the front lines.
Steve Cole, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Steve Cole is the author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. He's managing editor of the Washington Post. As we move from Afghanistan to Grenada, 1983, continuing to look at the Reagan years. We'll be back in a minute.
My sister, do you hear me? Stop it. Fight it. Stop it. Fight it. Me, I no go preach to you. Say that you not they do all. But if you, you must do shot. You better cover your back. This disease, they're for real. Think of the consequence. You better protect yourself. Come, come, my sisters, do you hear me? Come on, my children, do you hear me?
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
In the early morning hours of October 25th, 1983, the United States invaded the small Caribbean nation of Grenada. At the time, the country was governed by the fiery leftist President Maurice Bishop. The initial invasion consisted of some 1,200 U.S. troops.
These were the Reagan years. A few years before, during President Reagan's election campaign, he raised the issue of Grenada.
Totalitarian Marxists are in control of the Caribbean island of Grenada, where Cuban advisors are now training guerrillas for subversive action against other countries, such as Trinidad, Tobago, Grenada's democratic neighbor. In El Salvador, Marxist totalitarian revolutionaries, supported by Havana and Moscow, are preventing the construction of a democratic government. Must we let Grenada, Nicaragua, El Salvador all become additional Cubas, new outposts for Soviet combat brigades? With all of the terrorist and military threats confronting us, we need a first-class intelligent capability with high morale and dedicated people. We have the means to regenerate our intelligence organizations, and I would employ those means.
And so in the early morning hours of October 25th, 83, the United States invaded Grenada. We are joined now by the press secretary for President Maurice Bishop of Grenada from 81 to 83. Before that, he was editor-in-chief of Grenada's national newspaper, the Free West Indian. When the U.S. Marines invaded Grenada, he was deported by the U.S. military to Barbados. He is Don Rojas, currently the general manager of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much,
Amy. It's good to have you with us.
Good to see you and good to be with you and Juan. Yes.
So as we look back at the Reagan years, tell us about that morning, October 25th, 1983. Where were you?
I was actually in hiding. I was underground, so to speak, this coming a few days after the coup d'etat that had assassinated Prime Minister Maurice Bishop and several of his close colleagues. I was in hiding at the time. And the invasion, of course, brought tremendous fury, death and destruction in the first 24 hours and continuing for another week or so active fighting throughout the country, resulting in the deaths of many Grenadians and, of course, also many internationalist workers, including Cubans, who were there to help us construct the civilian international airport.
Well, Don, obviously an invasion of a country doesn't occur overnight. To what degree, in retrospect, and as you've been able to see the facts, was the invasion coordinated with the coup or was done with knowledge that the coup was about to occur?
No. The coup provided a pretext for the invasion to take place at that particular moment. In other words, taking advantage of an opportunity of internal destabilization as a result of the coup, confusion within the Grenadian society. The invasion, however, had been planned by the Reagan administration as far back as 1981. In fact, there were mock invasion military exercises on the island of Vieques off of Puerto Rico. Vieques happens to be very similar in topography to Grenada. So this had been in the works, so to speak, for at least 2 years before October of 1983.
So explain the chronology even before those morning hours of October 25th. I think it was a great surprise to many people in this country that
yes.
the U.S. was invading Grenada.
Yes.
In fact, I believe the press was kept off the island.
That's correct. The press was actually quarantined in Barbados for several days after the initial invading force came into Grenada. And, of course, this created a tremendous uproar within the international media community. But prior to that, of course, the Reagan administration had been conducting a very organized and concerted campaign of political, economic, diplomatic destabilization of the Bishop government, the revolutionary government of Prime Minister Maurice Bishop, from the time Reagan came into office. The justification for the invasion, as articulated by President Reagan, I would say was full of lies and distortions and falsifications. Reagan attempted to confuse the American people and the world by claiming that the Grenadian government was in fact building a Soviet and Cuban military base in the Caribbean region. That was totally false. Also by using the fact of American medical students on the island, claiming that they were, in fact, their lives were threatened by the Grenadian authorities. That was totally false.
Because there was a medical school, a U.S. medical school in Grenada.
There was and there is a U.S. Run, U.S.-owned medical school in Grenada. That's correct.
The famous scene of the students coming off the plane in the United States and one dropping to his knees and kissing the ground. Was he a medical student?
Not sure about that. However, I can tell you that in the period before the invasion, during the time of the internal coup d'etat that had killed Maurice Bishop, when the entire country was on a lockdown curfew and no one could have left their homes in Grenada, the only persons freely walking about the beaches of the country and the streets of the city were the American medical students.
And how did the United States troops, once they occupied the country, deal with those who had perpetrated the coup against Maurice Bishop?
Well, they were arrested, several of them, they were held in detention for many months. And then there was subsequently a trial, and they were sentenced to life imprisonment. They are still there, actually, in prison in Grenada after, 21 years.
What was Maurice Bishop trying to accomplish? When had he been elected? What were you doing in Grenada?
Well, I was serving the Maurice Bishop government at the time as the press secretary to the prime minister. Prior to that, I had served in the capacity of an editor of the national newspaper, the editor-in-chief, as you pointed out in your introduction. Maurice Bishop was attempting to empower the Grenadian people, a people who had been had a long history of slavery, followed by British colonialism, followed by independence in 1974. 5 years after formal independence from Britain, Maurice Bishop attempted to begin a social experiment to empower the Grenadian people, to involve them in the decision-making that would affect their daily lives, to bring a popular form of democracy to a country that had, for centuries, been under the thumb of foreign rulers, in this particular case, the British. Maurice Bishop's vision for Grenada was of a small country standing tall and proud in the Caribbean region and in the world community. And he was able to bring his message very successfully of a new way for Grenada and for the Caribbean to the world, to the United Nations, to the non-aligned movement, etc., and received tremendous acclaim around the world. At the time that of his death, he was he had an international stature that was, you might say, far out of proportion to the size of the country.
How did he die?
He was killed. He was assassinated on the morning of October the 19th in a bloody coup d'etat. Several other members of his cabinet and other leaders of the
Grenada
Revolution.
Do you think the U.S. had anything to do with it?
Not anything directly to do with it. We don't have any evidence of that as of yet. There have been a range of theories and speculations as to exactly how the U.S. was involved in the events of October the 19th. But I can say for certain that the U.S. was very much involved inside of Grenada in terms of their ongoing campaign to destabilize the country from 1979 all the way up to 1983.
Last year, Phyllis Bennis, Institute for Policy Studies, compared the invasion of Iraq with the invasion of Grenada, saying, I think what we're dealing with now is Grenada on steroids. This is Reagan on steroids. This is making a doctrine out of something that at the time was viewed as shocking. There was international outrage. Now there's international outrage, but it's muted by fear. And she said the invasion of Grenada was in some ways a symbolic act to everyone but the people of Grenada. It was designed to show that the U.S. is going to be the biggest and toughest kid on the block.
I think Phyllis is correct in that. And unfortunately, one of the smallest countries in the world was chosen to demonstrate this new toughness on the part of the most powerful nation in the world. It's a bitter irony.
And the reaction of the Caribbean community?
The reaction of the Caribbean community was mixed, Amy. Among the people of the Caribbean, I would say the vast majority of them opposed the U.S. invasion. There were some governments in the region that did support it, the government of Barbados, the government of Dominica. The government of Jamaica at the time was led by Prime Minister Seaga, who was a very close friend and ally of President Reagan at the time.
He was dubbed by some President Seaga.
Exactly. In fact, he holds the distinction of being the first foreign leader to be invited to dinner at the White House after Reagan was elected in 1981.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Don Rojas, now general manager of WBAI at the time, in hiding, ultimately sent off to Barbados.
Thank you very much,
the U.S.
Amy.
Government. Thanks for being with us. We're going to take a brief
break. And thanks
for
remembering Grenada.
And then we're going to return with our series, Remembering the Dead. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! As we continue our series, Remembering the Dead, we go from Reagan's foreign policies to those at home.
As America remembers the life of Ronald Reagan with the first state funeral in three decades, one issue that is rarely being mentioned is AIDS. Following the discovery of the first cases of AIDS in 1981, it soon became clear a national health crisis was developing. Scientists, researchers, and healthcare professionals at every level expressed a need for funding, but the Reagan White House remained silent on the subject. Writing in the Washington Post in 1985, Representative Henry Waxman of Los Angeles stated, quote, "It is surprising that the president could remain silent as 6,000 Americans died. That he could fail to acknowledge the epidemic's existence. Perhaps his staff felt he had to, since many of this new right supporters have raised money by campaigning against homosexuals."
Those were the words of Congressmember Waxman. Reagan finally addressed the issue of AIDS near the end of his second term. His remarks came May 31st, 1987, at the Third International Conference on AIDS in Washington. Present at that address was Andy Hum, co-host of Gay USA, the weekly gay and AIDS news program for the last two decades. He's the director of the education at the Hedrick Martin Institute for Lesbian and Gay Youth, which in 1986 started one of the first AIDS education programs in the country. He joins us now.
Well, that was back then. I mean, I left Hedrick Martin in 95, but Ronald Reagan was either one of the stupidest or most evil people ever to hold this office. If you just look at this crisis alone, which now is affecting 70 million people around the globe, this guy just sat on his hands and let this thing get out of control. I mean, you know, even from a conservative point of view, this is something that the world can't handle now. And, it's because he hated gay people and he hated people of color.
Can you explain?
Well, explain. I mean, the chain of events. The first reports we had of AIDS were in 1981. Reagan was already president. This came from the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly, a report that a strange cancer was being seen in gay people. I mean, and nothing was done about it. I mean, we had Legionnaire's disease just a little bit before that, and it was front page news all of the time. The press, of course, was complicit in this. The Times did one little story in 1981 and then didn't do another story for a couple of years. It's funny, when Reagan's obit, four-page obit, was done in the Times the first day, it was no mention of the AIDS crisis. Somebody said, well, the Times must have constructed it from their own clips because they didn't cover the AIDS crisis in those days. So, I mean, look, there's a lot of blame to go around, but this was the president of the United States. I mean, he wouldn't speak about it. We looked at old press conferences in those days. They made jokes about AIDS at the press conferences, and this included the press and the press spokespersons. But finally, in 1987, 6.5 years into the crisis, he gives a speech at an AMFAR fundraiser. And, you know, a lot of us were like really hopeful. Okay, finally, because we're being devastated by this. Our friends are dying. Nobody understands. Nobody knows what's going on. It was like living in two worlds. And then, you know, he said something, you know, so we're hopeful that he's going to come up with something that the world's going to get moving on this. And then he started, of course, lapsing into this right-wing stuff about, well, we need to mandatorily test people in prison, blah, blah, you know, this kind of stuff. So we started booing. And it was a great release. And we realized he really wasn't going to change anything. He really wasn't going to address it. And we booed him. And he's this, you know, guy's just standing there kind of befuddled. Why am I here? You know, why am I being booed? I'm a good man, you know. I mean, he's completely out of it. And I don't think he'd ever been. I don't remember another instance as president where he was put in the position where he was booed. It was good for him.
And, of course, we have now George Bush, who many believe is the closest in legacy to Ronald Reagan. He has mentioned AIDS quite often in several of his speeches and State of the Union addresses, but specifically in terms of Africa, and it's been largely talk, hasn't it?
Exactly. I mean, the money is not getting to the people. We have drugs that are helping a lot of people in this country live more sustained lives on AIDS. It's not a cure. But we could get these drugs relatively easily to people around the globe. It can be done, and we won't do it. You know, we're still concentrating on things like abstinence programs and this kind of stuff. It's still a right-wing agenda is being run. The money is not being rolled out the way he says it is, but he just likes to say the word AIDS, Bush, so that it gets you to feel that he's more compassionate about things. Folks, don't buy it. It's not happening. And it's got to happen or, you know, again, millions of people are going to die.
Andy Hum, what was being done at the time as we continue the series Remembering the Dead, looking at the 1980s from Central America to Afghanistan, Grenada, now here at home with AIDS? In the gay community, in the progressive community in this country, to get the Reagan administration to deal with AIDS?
Well, I mean, nobody was listening. I mean, you know, even here in New York City, Ed Koch wasn't listening. And, of course, he's a great defender of Reagan's. You know, he was complicit in that. They did ironically have a Surgeon General, Everett Koop, who was appointed because he was an anti-abortion zealot, and a lot of us opposed him, and he really tried to get the word, because he's a doctor, and he knew that this was a medical crisis, and eventually did write a pamphlet that was distributed to Americans, again, very late. But you have to remember at the time, who was the domestic policy advisor? Gary Bauer, who was a complete fringe nut right character. Who was the communications director? Pat Buchanan. I mean, you know, these people are maniacs. The only thing that makes me feel good at this point is that Reagan is dead and Larry Kramer is still alive, who's had AIDS for 20 years.
Well, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and other LGBT BT civil rights groups will be closed on Friday to protest what they're calling Reagan's lack of respect for people with AIDS.
Yeah, if people want to send condolences, send them to the families of people who died of AIDS. That's what you should be doing this week.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Andy Hum. And that does it for today's program. Juan, tonight you're going to be in an event.
Yes, at the Columbia Law School, there is a book party and reading for a new book by David Gilbert, who has been in prison now for more than 20 years, was a classmate of mine at Columbia and one of the founders of Columbia SDS, and that's at 7 o'clock tonight. I'll be doing a partial reading from that book with other people.
And that's tonight at...
At 7 p.m. at the Columbia Law School at 116th in Amsterdam.
And tonight I'll be at the Spring Glen United Church of Christ as we continue our Exception to the Ruler's Tour in Hamden, Connecticut. Tomorrow in at Harvard Science Center at 3. On Saturday, Baltimore at 7:30 at Unity United Methodist Church. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.